Presenting Danforth Dialogues, a monthly podcast on leadership, hosted by Morehouse School of Medicine President and CEO, Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice. This month, we are pleased to have Dr. Gary H. Gibbons, Director of the National Health, Lung, and Blood Institute. Raised in the Germantown neighborhood of Philadelphia, Dr. Gibbons graduated from Princeton University and received his medical degree from Harvard Medical School. Dr. Gibbons, who has headed NHLBI since 2012, served on the faculties of Stanford University and Harvard Medical School. In 1999, he joined the Morehouse School of Medicine and founded our Cardiovascular Research Institute, which has become a leader in conducting research on the cardiovascular health of minorities. Dr. Gibbons has received several patents for innovations derived from his research in the fields of vascular biology and vascular diseases. In 2007, Dr. Gibbons was named a member of the Institute of Medicine. He was selected as a Robert Woods Johnson Foundation Minority Faculty Development Awardee and a Pew Foundation Biomedical Scholar. He is the recipient of the American Heart Association Research Achievement Award and the Samuel J. Heyman Service to American Medical. Dr. Gibbons and Dr. Montgomery Rice will talk about the state of health equity in communities of color and the leadership lessons he has learned over his long and distinguished career. Now, for this month's episode, here is Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice.
Welcome to the Danforth Dialogues. Starting with our founder, Dr. Lewis W. Sullivan, who became Secretary of Health and Human Services under President George H.W. Bush's administration, the Morehouse School of Medicine has become, I would say, a bit renowned for the people who have been affiliated with the medical school, going on to lead major leadership opportunities in the federal government. For example, our former president, Dr. David Satcher, was the only person to serve as the U.S. Surgeon General and the director for the Centers for Disease Control. So we are especially honored today to have as our guest, Dr. Gary H. Gibbons, and he'll tell us what that H stands for, another member of the MSM family who is a national leader in public health and leads NHLBI, the third largest institute in the National Institutes of Health. But what makes this time really special for us is Dr. Gibbons is a leader that we helped develop at Morehouse School of Medicine. As he led the Cardiovascular Research Institute many, many years ago, I know that this is going to be a powerful conversation because you're going to see what it means for someone to come full circle and understanding what it means to lead the creation and advancement of health equity to achieve health justice. Welcome home, Dr. Gibbons.
Good to be home.
Thank you for being here. So let's talk first about this journey. And I want to share with the audience, I would like for you to share with the audience, really, what does it mean to actually have come from Germantown, your upbringing, to go to Princeton, to go to Harvard Medical School. And I actually believe that you may have graduated from Harvard Medical School magna cum laude, which I went to Harvard Medical School and I don't quite know what that means, so you might have to share that with us. But let's talk about just that first part of the journey.
Germantown is part of Philadelphia. It was and still is. Predominantly African-American community. Quite frankly, it was composed of more working class folks. There are actually neighborhoods that are far more humble and impoverished in Philadelphia. My parents were school teachers, and particularly back then, they didn't make much money, but it was a good neighborhood. It's one of those neighborhoods where everybody was your parent on the block. And you can go in anybody's house, and everybody was watching for you. And so I think that's a special part of growing up in a neighborhood like that. Our church was just a few blocks away. And so, my mother was one of the founding members of our church. And indeed, one of the things that she helped create in that church was a nursery school. Again, as a working mom, making a faith-based organization be supportive of the neighborhood. So I have a lot of fond memories of growing up in Germantown. We probably didn't know all the things we didn't have, but we had what we needed. Growing up there, I'm part of what I think has been described as the Joshua generation. So born in 1956, so you can imagine I came of age in elementary school in the 60s. So after the Supreme Court decision that Brown decision that opened up integration, particularly in schools, led to the integration even of schools in Philadelphia, because there were these enclaves of neighborhoods that in essence were relatively segregated. And so the neighborhood schools were. And so I was bused actually only about 8 blocks away to another neighborhood that was actually predominantly Jewish at that time. And that was in second grade. So I went from a school that literally is a block away to 10 blocks away, but it was like in a different space. The school that I had been in kindergarten, first grade, they still had, I remember the coal trucks that would come by to heat the old building, because it probably was about 50 or 100 years old even then. And then went 10 blocks away to a school that just had been built in the 50s with all the modern amenities.
So let me interrupt you there, because you just imprinting, you know, it's real. And you brought back a memory for me when we finally got around to integration in the South, and I was living in Macon, Georgia, and my address was 812 Edwards Avenue. And people with the even numbers, we got moved to the other school. People with the odd numbers got to stay in the school that had been my first grade school. And I remember what it felt like to get on that bus and to go to that school and to recognize that that wasn't your home. How do you think that has influenced your career?
Well, certainly I became familiar with that notion of going into a space where, in contrast to the neighborhood where everyone around me looked like me and experienced similar life experiences as well as their parents, to one where I was the only one like me in the room.
Yeah.
Indeed, I was the only one who got off a bus, had to get on a bus to go to school. Everybody else walked across the street. I also remember lunchtime, because in that neighborhood, kids went back to their home to eat lunch. Many of them had, you know, moms who were there, prepare their lunch, and then they come back, go to class. But the kids from the bus, they had to pull out some tables in the gym. And we had obviously had to bring our lunch. No kitchen, so you brought your lunch. So you had that sense that you were different, an other. And I won't dwell on it, but there also were sections back in those days. Who was gifted or...
Oh, I remember the gifted classes. Yeah.
Higher achievers or not. And because I was a little bit precocious, I was in, one of the more advanced class settings. But even amongst those on the bus, I was one of the few in that kind of class.
Yeah.
So.
So you took that foundation and you went to Princeton.
Well, let me back you up. So because another key juncture was went from that elementary school. Back in the day, they used to call them junior high school. So after you finished sixth grade, they didn't have middle schools in those days, as I recall. So I went to a junior high school, and the junior high school was back in my neighborhood.
Okay, all right.
So then that was maybe five blocks away. So I was, again, back into having gone to the integrated school, back into pretty much a segregated school for seventh grade. And that was another shift. That was a school where, and at that time in Philly, there were literally gang wars, that each, a lot of those neighborhoods had their own gangs. And back in those days, it wasn't just, you know, drug lords or things. It was just, sounds bizarre to even think about it, but just what neighborhood you came from could start a fight.
Okay.
So, all right. So then at schools, you might have different people from different sub neighborhoods. So there'd just be, you know, fights in the lunchroom and after school, et cetera. But again, I was in one of those sections that was for the, you know, more so quote unquote accelerated students. And I still remember the fact that even in that select classroom, we had at least five different homeroom teachers because of the turnover. It was clear that it was not a desirable place as perceived to be a teacher. My parents as teachers recognized that that probably was not going to be the best for my development. And I still don't know how they pulled it off, but I had an opportunity to go to a private school, Episcopal Academy, that's right on the suburbs of Philadelphia, actually is as old as the U.S. Constitution. So it is taught sort of the blue bloods of Philadelphia for generations. And so the most wealthy families would send their children to Episcopal Academy and other similar sort of schools that are in a network. So that was another situation where I was coming in where, and this was probably in the, maybe around 68. And you can imagine almost like a George Floyd moment. 68 was an explosive year in this country. And there was a sense that this school that is as old as the U.S. Constitution didn't have many children of color or students of color. And so I guess an enlightenment bulb lit, they started an outreach. And so I was part of that probably experiment to see if they could bring in students of color to that very elite sort of school. So that was also an important exposure to me because, again, it was a different kind of setting, a similar sense that you're on this Joshua generation path, but now in a different context. And it was a very elite context. So not only was it race, but wealth and economic differences. So, you know, these are folks who would come back and talk about where they went for summer vacation. Yeah, we were lucky if we found a place where there was a pool.
That you could get in.
That we could get in.
Right, right.
Let alone, you know, traveling. So that was a different kind of shift. But I say that to say that also, I probably should say this in a correct way, but it actually, I think, was formative of a confidence and self-belief, because I felt that even though these individuals had every advantage one could have, I was not cowered, quite frankly, nor impressed that they were any smarter than I was. I think that reinforced a self-belief that I could be in that setting. Even though I felt different, I think I belonged there. And in fact, graduated top of that class.
Yeah, and so, you know, that I would venture to say that those early experiences really make a difference, because I will definitely say I have never found you be a person who didn't have confidence. And particularly many of you, when we got to Harvard Medical School, there seemed to be a pipeline from Princeton to Harvard. And it was definitely, I would say, refreshing to see that there were many persons who definitely had done well and came from humble means to be on this pathway. So you get to Harvard Medical School. You do extremely well there. And I will say that, you know, it is pretty rare to have magna cum laude graduating from Harvard Medical School. How do you get magna cum laude graduate from Harvard Medical School when we had pass fail in most of the curriculum?
Yeah, well, most of the curriculum is pass fail. But particularly in the clinical phase,
yeah,
you could get an honors. I was fortunate that for many of my major rotations, I received honors. And in addition, as you know, that I had my first tastes of research when I was a medical student. It wasn't part of the plan. I didn't apply to an MD, PhD, or master's program. So I kind of improvised a path, but nevertheless that led to a research experience that was probably 2 years in duration, in which actually I did sit in on graduate courses and developed a thesis.
So you took a little bit longer to graduate.
That's correct.
So you didn't follow a standard course.
That's correct.
Right. Yeah. But you didn't follow a course that said, okay, I can do research, mm-hmm. and I don't necessarily have to go get a PhD, mm-hmm. and still can be rewarded for that,
yeah.
as
yeah.
demonstrated by the magna cum laude.
Right.
I think that's important to point out to the audience of students who might be listening, because I know that when we were there, we always had the opportunity to go get an MBA. If I could do it back over again, I would have definitely gone to Harvard Business School and got an MBA. I mean, because you could do it in a short amount of time, but there was nobody really necessarily saying, okay, go get that MBA. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I spent my entire fourth year of medical school doing basic science research, but didn't graduate magna cum laude. Just want to put that out there. You definitely have that up on me. But it was a great place to be that allowed you to forge your own pathway. And with that, you then went on to do internal medicine,
correct.
Cardiology. And what got you to cardiology? I do think that that's important to emphasize.
Yeah, well, my research experience was sort of grounded in a question that I had posed to my mentor at that time as to why hypertension was more prevalent in African-American communities. And so he studied blood pressure regulation. And so that's what I did. It was an animal model, actually a conscious dog model that we used at that time. And so that was fascinating to me for physiology. Literally, the conscious dog model, I could do a manipulation that would make the dog hypertensive within about 30 minutes by constricting the renal artery and activating the renin angiotensin system. So just watching and working with that physiology has stuck with me forever. That's probably why I was inclined toward cardiology, because in essence, in humans, you're in a cardiac catheterization lab.
Right.
You're measuring those same pressures and hemodynamics, or in a coronary care unit. And that's what we're manipulating and changing. So I always loved cardiology. Because literally you could take someone who was close to death, if not dead, and resuscitate and restore in a short time frame. And so to me, that was just very powerful as a clinician to see somebody suffering, but because of what you knew and that physiology knowledge that you could apply in real time with agents that you know manipulated in a particular way that could change the course of somebody's life. I couldn't think of anything better to do as a physician.
So internal medicine, cardiology, you could have stayed at Harvard in the Harvard teaching system if you wanted to at that time, but you chose to go to Stanford. You wanted that, wanted to check that box off. You wanted California.
So I was an instructor at Harvard Medical School, and I had opportunity to stay, and indeed was offered, but I had met another mentor in that laboratory in physiology, who was a postdoctoral fellow at the time, Victor Zhao, and Victor had been chief resident to Brigham and was already becoming junior faculty. Indeed, Dr. Bronwald, his mentor, had even created a little niche for him to start to grow as a leader, actually created a vascular medicine division, one of its early ones, to retain him, but also to give him an opportunity to lead, develop a program. Actually, one of the people he worked with in that was Dr. Joe Lascalzo, who subsequently became chair of medicine after Victor. And actually that group was a terrific group. But I was kind of growing up as a fellow in that context. And Victor got an opportunity to go from that small division to be chief of cardiology at Stanford. He wanted to recruit me to go there. And I actually had a number of other opportunities at that, either to stay or go to another number of different institutions. But Victor made a good opportunity for me at Stanford. And it was an exciting and great place to be.
And it doesn't snow in California.
There you go.
Not yet.
Well, and you can travel there. To it. You can go to Tahoe.
And so I thank you for spending this time laying this foundation and showing this pathway for our students who are thinking about their career paths. I wanted them to get the sense of the things that stimulate your decisions, but that also create opportunities, and that there's no straight line.
Correct.
Because I know that when you were asked to serve on the advisory committee for Morehouse School of Medicine, where we were building up our capacity to do research, you did not know that you were also being recruited to actually start a foundation, a new pathway for us here about how we thought about health disparities, how we thought about diseases that disproportionately impacted people of color. But you had all the makings of a person who could lead this cardiovascular research institute. So did you know that at that time?
Not really. I thought I was being helpful. I, quite frankly, was pretty comfortable where I was at Harvard at that point, having coming back from Stanford. At that point, Victor was chair of medicine. He had taken Eugene Bronwald's spot. And so I had been fairly successful. I had about three R01s at that point.
You had three R01s?
Yeah.
At the same time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As a junior faculty there. And, my mentor is the chair. I'm back to where I grew up as a trainee and knew the place, knew the players. It actually was part of that dream. Sometimes when you're in that lecture hall in the first year medical student, you see all those pictures on the wall of people who don't look like me. And at that point, you could probably count the number of Harvard faculty at a lunch table. I did have, I could confess now, a vision that, Harvard talks about you being a leader in academic medicine. That's why you're there. And so why not here? So to be on the Harvard faculty, with accomplished some things in research and getting awards and mentors that were looking out for my career, I was good. I had achieved a lot of the things that I had set out to do. You know, but I was probably just, maybe early 40 or something. And I could have continued to do that. And so I really wasn't looking for anything. And I must admit, one of the things I share with young people as well is that I haven't looked for a job. I'm trying to think of it. Since I was a fellow, including the one I'm in now. For some reason, you know, doors and opportunities open. And that's why it's not linear.
That's right.
It's not a plan.
And I'm glad you said it, because that's not being boastful, but it is about also opportunities seek out people who are living out their purpose aligned with their passion. And so you make the decision, and I know there's a lot of details that got you down here, but you find yourself about to accept this role to be the founding director of the Cardiovascular Research Institute at the Morehouse School of Medicine, a school that has probably at that time about 42 MD students per year, if I recall. They have a couple of students who are getting masters. They have a couple of students maybe who could think about getting a PhD. They have a master's of public health. I would say that the operating budget for the school at that time was probably maybe $100 million, maybe.
Generous, I think. You
okay,
have to check
right.
the record.
Maybe I'm being generous. Yeah, because back then I would say it's probably about 75. I'm going to say 75 million. And you go and you tell Victor that this is what you want to do. Now, you don't have to give this to that Victor. You don't have to attribute this to Victor. But what were maybe some of the things that people said to you when you told them that you were going to make this move?
Well,
the good and the interesting.
I'll say that it's part of the Harvard ethos that it is the preeminent medical school in their view. And they attract a concentration of the leaders in medicine. And this is where you want to be a leader at the lead institution in academic medicine. And quite frankly, there's a beltway around Boston called Route 128. And so there was a sense that there's actually a caricature picture that if you went past that 128, that was like the world is flat and it just falls off from there.
It just falls off. And some people told you that too. Yeah. It just falls off.
Yeah. So why would you ever, go to any place else, let alone a place that at that point was just thinking about building a research wing?
Right. Were we still in the trailers at that point?
There was a trailer still on campus, I recall. May need some of the historians here, but yeah. I recall a trailer or two still here.
Okay.
And certainly we heard the trailer story I still remember this still being a gravel parking lot where we are now. Because even the garage was kind of in construction.
So what was it that you saw? And the impact that you thought that you would have that made you make the decision?
Well, I must admit, this is where I really appreciate Dr. Salt and his leadership and his vision, because starting from a trailer, he saw this as it is now, I believe. And it was his compelling vision and clear commitment to fulfilling it and making a reality that convinced me that I could be part of creating that vision with him. That was compelling.
That's really important. So thank you for that. And I want the audience to appreciate that you do have these times in your career, particularly when you're stepping out. we're both people of faith. And I know you were stepping out somewhat on faith.
Yep.
And understanding the abilities that you had to make those dreams become a reality. I want to get to leadership, and I think this is going to really lean into that. Can you tell us the three things that you believe that you did while you were here that has had a major impact on Morehouse School of Medicine?
I must admit, I prefer to leave it to others in terms of the impact on Morehouse School of Medicine. But, you know, one of the things that I resonate with is a book by Jim Collins, Good to Great. And he talks about leadership with audacious humility. And for me, a lot of that is embodied. I believe in both Dr. Sullivan and Satcher, who I always consider role models in that. There was a confidence. Both of them are Morehouse men. I'm not. But there's a confidence that they had.
They have it. Yes, they do.
That gives them that audacity to think big, to have a vision that's so far beyond what actually exists, or that they actually have the resources to fulfill. But that self-confidence, self-belief, that nevertheless, it can be done. I think that can be infectious. But it's approached with a humility, because it's not about their personal ego, but it's what it can do for others. Obviously, the dividends of that vision continue to be reaped generation after generation. And so that's where it's not about me or you. It's about what can be done for those who come behind us. With that notion that the old folks used to say, if you're the first to do something, just don't be the last.
Just don't be the last. That's
right. And that you lift as you rise. And so I always got that sense that both Sullivan and Satcher were about not only that vision, but bringing people along such that they can fulfill their vision and expand upon what they left.
So one of the things I can say, we are incredibly proud of the work and the impact that the Cardiovascular Research Institute had in shining, I believe, a much needed light on cardiovascular health and cardiovascular health disparities in communities of color. But I would be interested in your view now on where do we stand in improving health equity for underserved communities, and where should we really focus our efforts on moving the needle?
Well, actually an extension of your last question, you know, I was recruited in, and they used this term of as a magnet investigator. So the notion was perhaps leveraging the training and experience I had had, that as a founding director, I could create something that would bring others. You know, that might sound as if, you know, I'm messianic and coming in to fix and build something. But it, again, as part of audacious humility, it was quite the opposite. I learned far more here than I imparted by coming here. And to your point, it's because of the mission here of serving the underserved that really gave me that different lens of equity, and perhaps a pathway to address it, because the Morehouse School of Medicine had that tradition of and practice of engaging communities in co-creating solutions that were meaningful to those communities that had some of the greatest disparities as a means of ameliorating them, if not eliminating them. Dr. Satcher preached that a lot.
He still does.
And I'm sure it still does.
He still does.
And so I learned a lot about engaging communities by just being here and how what I knew was if I was going to create a cardiovascular research institute here, it wasn't going to be like I would at Stanford or at Harvard. It would still be as excellent, but leveraging the context and the particular strengths and assets that only Morehouse School of Medicine could bring to that question. And I think that helped recognize that even as we sit here, we had been on a good 50-year trend toward decreasing cardiovascular morbidity and mortality across the country, a great trajectory, one, quite frankly, that in my current position we're proud of from the NHOBI, because we invested in a lot of things to promote that curve. But it stalled during this century. And one of the reasons it stalled is that there were some communities that were continuing that improvement
decrease.
Trajectory,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there were others
that was increasing.
That were flattening or even increasing. And so that's where the notion that if we were really going to start bending that curve again, that we really had to go to the most vulnerable, those who were being left behind, and focus a lot more of our energy on addressing those inequalities as a means to getting that curve going down again. Mm-hmm.
So how did you do this when you know that there were behaviors and practices that people were making, whether for themselves or for their children or for their families, that contributed to the cardiovascular health disparities? And I will tell you something. You said something one day, and I use it all the time. And I had just gotten here, and you were, we were at a lunch, and you said, gravy is not a beverage. Do you remember telling me? And I say that all the time because we would have these heavy lunches.
And
we
breakfast.
And breakfast, right. And you would say, like, gravy is not a beverage. So understanding that may be part of the culture, what did you learn? What did you do differently in this cardiovascular research institute that we could say that to a community or an individual and it not be offensive, but you were trying to get a message across that they may want to think differently about how they eat?
Yeah. No, and I learned while I was here. And so, their colleagues, actually are at the Morehouse School of Medicine Clinical Research Center, that would go into communities and walk through with people about those healthy choices. I still remember having health fairs where part of it was almost creating basically a farmer's market and a cooking sessions.
Yeah.
Actually leveraging some of the NHOBI data on the DASH diet, which we know lowers blood pressure, and doing it and cooking in a way, even if it's a jambalaya, that could be heart healthy, but still tastes good. In fact, I remember there was a restaurant around the corner sold vegetarian. And so if indeed we could meet people where they are.
There you go.
And learn from them. And adapt our science, perhaps we can change some of those behaviors. So, yeah.
So you're not only a leading scientist and a thought leader, but now you lead a $3 billion NIH institution with more than, 900 employees or how many?
If you count the contractors, about 2,000.
About 2,000 employees.
Yep.
What's your secret to effective leadership?
I don't know if I have a secret. I guess a few things. Part of it is I was told by, the old folks, there's a reason you have two ears and one mouth. So I try to spend a lot of time listening. meeting people where they are and learning with them and from them. There's an element that I think is a through line for me, and that's curiosity. I think I've always been curious. It's really probably my drive being a scientist. I like to understand how and why things work the way they do. As a physician scientist, why they go awry and people get sick and suffer. I think that also translates into leadership, that in engaging people, everybody has a story and a perspective, and trying to understand. I was influenced by a book that I often recommend, even though it's been around a long time, Stephen Covey's book, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. So if you're talking about secrets, I derive some of that from that one as well. And one of those key things was seek to understand rather than be understood. The notion of dialogue, in which it's not about me convincing you of my position and what I believe, but also listening and understanding, even if you have a different point of view, where you're coming from. And I think that's important, whether you're on the front lines and rank and file employee, or you're on an executive team. I think part of leadership is being sure you turn around and someone's following you.
Yeah.
And I think if you're someone who has a vision, but also listen to how other folks might share that vision, or moving them toward a shared vision that incorporates their perspective, that's part of moving an organization forward. And again, I think a lot of it comes with that audacious humility, audacious enough to engage and inspire people to follow toward a shared vision, but a humility to understand that at the end of the day, they're the ones that are going to make it possible.
Thank you. So every leader has had times of failure when things didn't go quite as planned. You have any that you want to share with us and the lessons that you learned that help you down the road?
I must admit, I struggle with this question. Again, it's with all humility. Yes, there are things that did not go as I expected. There are things that did not go as planned. You can't be a scientist and have experiments that don't work. Maybe I'm the only one that has experiments that don't work. But invariably, it didn't work the way I thought it was supposed to work. If designed, it just told me a different answer than the one I was expecting.
Right.
So I don't consider that failure.
Right.
That's part of me chipping away at my ignorance, which there's a lot of. And so if I don't encounter the unexpected, I don't think I'm at an edge. I don't think I'm pushing. I don't think I'm stretching. I don't think I'm growing. If I already know it all and know where it's going to go, that's where I get my energy. I know it's there to teach me something. Even when I fall down, even when I struggle, that could be personally, relationships, everything else. It's teaching me something about me, maybe where I can be better, where I can grow better. And I hope I learned something from it. And in that sense, I can't conceive of it as a failure, because it actually is part of a positive intention. I have no regrets about things. Yeah, a lot of things haven't turned out well. There's some rough spots, some things I shouldn't have done, mistakes I maybe shouldn't have made, but it's all learning.
Great.
That's a work in progress.
We all continue to be. Thank you for sharing that. So you've had the pleasure of being with us for several days, interacting with our students and our faculty. You are our speaker yesterday at the Curtis Parker Annual Research Symposium. You've been a former faculty member. And I would be interested to hear your impressions of Morehouse School of Medicine today.
Wow. Well, you all never cease to both amaze and inspire me. I actually brag about you when I go other places, because I've been at an academic institution practically in every state in this country now. And I do these, you know, roundtables and listening tours. But I dare say I have not encountered a more mission-focused and centered academic institution than Morehouse School of Medicine in all my travels at academic, certainly medical centers and medical schools. And that's a testimony both to leadership and faculty and students. That part of your DNA and your culture is always refreshing to come back. And so when I come back home, it refuels me in that way. Indeed, I think it's probably what, again, prepared me for my current position, which is a privilege of public service, which has some of those same elements. I lead an organization that's very mission-driven. People don't work at that agency because of the money or because it's easy to be a Fed, but they're there because they're the mission. So that experience here taught me about that.
Great. So, Gary, you've had an incredible career. I would like to close with you giving some pieces of advice to our students and our faculty. And I know how passionate you are about our students. I know how passionate you have always been about our faculty. I shared yesterday in my remarks when I was introducing you that you gave me an email. It's about 4 or 5 pages long. In 2019, you had come here for something. I can't remember what it was. It might have been graduation, where you were speaking or whatever. And when you got home, you wrote me this email, and it was very futuristic. It was very much about where we should lean in. And I know you don't think I listen to you, but I actually listened to what you wrote and have used it as a guidepost in thinking about the things. You talked a lot about data. You talked about the importance of what data was going to mean in the next 10 years. You talked about leaning into the faculty and the support that the faculty need, as you really talked about the student and the learning environment. So I would like for you to share just some closing pieces of advice for the student and faculty, particularly for ones who may aspire to be the head of an IC at the NIH, or even be the head of the NIH. What pieces of advice would you leave them with?
Yeah, well, I always come back, as you do, I think, to passion and purpose. Those elements of self-belief that I think gives you that resilience, that when you inevitably encounter adversity and you fall, and as you put it, you fail, to get back up again. It's just that failure is not the end of it, but it's a growth opportunity. And a lot of that comes, I believe, from recognizing that, you know, many of us do have those sort of humble starts. But it's, you know, it's not where you start, but where you finish. And I think that you've seen role models of that. In my talk, I quote Isaac Newton: if you see further than others have seen before, because he stands on the shoulders of giants. That's a great opportunity if you're a student here, that you're enjoying a proud legacy of those who came before. And I always touchstone with that as an inspiration, that they started out and created, had a vision for this, that you now are realizing. And this isn't the end, the Morehouse School of Medicine. Indeed, it's getting ready for its next 50, right?
That's right.
Who's going to drive that next 50?
That's right.
So it's probably somebody who's a student right now.
Yeah, probably. Definitely. Yeah, yeah. 50 is, yeah, not another 50. Yeah, not for me.
Even though you're only 25.
I know. It's amazing how I have an age. Yes. So thank you. This has just been wonderful to reconnect. I can tell you, when I first met you at HMS, I couldn't have imagined that we would be sitting here being able to have this opportunity, the honors that have been bestowed upon us to be able to sit in these seats and stand on the shoulders of many. I know you nor I take this for granted. So thank you for being here with us. Thank you so much for joining us today on Danforth Dialogues. In closing, we always offer our three thoughts on leadership. Our first thought today is that people who are succeeding usually end up leading. It's not difficult to spot a great leader. You will usually find them at the top of their class, like Dr. Gibbons. Great leaders stand out all along the way. They're first in their classes, number one in their sports, the best at whatever they set their minds to do, and they know how to win. Second, great leaders can build from the ground up. I can guarantee you that Dr. Gibbons had to build from the ground up when he came here as the founding director of the Cardiovascular Research Institute. He had to start from scratch. He had to take an idea and make it into something. And what he made this cardiovascular research into is a healthcare organization. And I really do use the word as healthcare, because he was understanding that we first needed to care in order to lead people down a pathway to health. That is what the Cardiovascular Research Institution is for Morehouse School of Medicine. And finally, great leaders bring their knowledge back home. Dr. Gibbons could have stayed away at Harvard Medical School, but he chose to come to Morehouse School of Medicine. He understood that there was a practical need to be able to bring to an organization what you've learned, but to bring that expertise back into the community and give that opportunity to the community to co-create with them solutions. He knew that Black people were 54% more likely to die from cardiovascular disease than others. So when he had the chance to address that diversity and that disparity, he took it on. And in the process, he left a legacy of Morehouse School of Medicine to lead the creation and advancement of health equity. So thank you, Dr. Gibbons. We appreciate your leadership, we appreciate your expertise, and we appreciate the time that you have spent with us these last couple of days. Thank you to the audience for joining us for this edition of Danforth Dialogue. As always, good health and great success in all you do.
This has been a presentation of Danforth Dialogues with Morehouse School of Medicine President and CEO, Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. For more information, please contact us at danforthdialogues@msm.edu.